Okay.
Okay.
Well, you're listening to Faded Mates. I am Sarah McLean, and I am here with my friend...
Jennifer Prokop,
my faded mate, my faded romance mate. And this is episode 3 of Faded Mates. Thank you for sticking with us. And we are reading this week... what are we reading?
Dark Knees in a Winter's Night.
No. We don't know. We have no idea what we're reading.
Sarah, let's be honest that we love this series, but we are struggling with the titles little bit.
You know, it's because romance novels have title problems. I mean, let's just acknowledge it. Can we just acknowledge it?
Like, yes.
Romance novels are hard to title because readers have expectations. And there are only so many times that you can write Wicked Winter's Warlock whatever.
Dark. And it's almost like a magic eight ball made these titles at some point.
It really is. I mean, I gotta say, right? I mean, I have some crazy titles, but the reality is that especially in the mid-thousands when Cressley was titling these books, you know, every book was, you know, Dukes and Wickedness and Sin. Like, so, yeah, it's hard. But then about halfway through, this series gets so big that the titles just become characters' names. And that's pretty great.
It was great. I was like, this is a good naming protocol. I actually have a pretty half-baked theory about, because you were like, why are, you know, and I was like, I think the way it works is, and I feel like I have to put a tinfoil hat on to actually, like, explain the entire thing.
Jen, like, I think you're right.
Yeah, I was like, I think a word from the previous title appears in the next title. So, like, a hunger like no other, and then we get no rest for the wicked, and then wicked deeds. And because I've spent so much time thinking about this, like, how are they? And then I was like, oh, it's like a big game of hopscotch, right? Like, one title is just, like, sort of building the bridge to the next one.
Yes.
That's my theory.
Yes. I fully endorse it, especially when you look at next week's title. But what's important is that this week's title is Wicked Deeds on a Winter's Night. Also slightly complicated because it's not really winter in this book at all. It's set in a tropical jungle, mostly.
She's wearing a string bikini for a lot of it, and
she
shorts.
Really is. But then, like, it's winter. It's the dark winter of the hero's soul, and that's what's important. We all know the climate of the hero's soul is the most important
thing. That is the most important thing for naming a book, for sure.
In a book. So, Wicked Deeds on a Winter's Night introduces us to the witches.
Oh, I love this so much.
The witches are here, finally. And our heroine, Mariketta the Awaited, is a young, super young, you guys. First, I mean, Emma was young, too. But wasn't Emma, like, 60?
Mariketta's an actual co-ed, not kind of impersonating a co-ed because she just looks really young because she's an immortal. Mariketta's 23. She's 23.
And she is not immortal yet. And that's a big piece of this puzzle. Because that adds a whole level. We've talked so much about how Cressley and paranormal in general, like, up the stakes and up the stakes and up the stakes and keep the stakes really high. Well, in this book, the heroine isn't immortal, so she can die. And that changes everything. So anyway, we have our heroine, Mariketta the Awaited, who is the first of the heroines in the books, or characters in the books, who is a witch. She is, she has been, essentially, she has been awaited for many, many, many thousands of years, right? And here she is, finally, she is expected to basically take on the mantle of saving the coven and also potentially saving the world.
Well, and I we talked a little bit about like person versus fate last time, and I love a story where there's a prophecy. And so one of the things we know about Mariketta, the awaited part, is that she has the only witch who is essentially an expert in all five of the witches' castes. She is more powerful than any other witch has ever been, and it, her arrival has been forecast, and she doesn't know what it is she's going to be expected to do, but this idea that that her destiny is one of greatness, and yet she's so young. I just it's the building blocks of a really great character.
And on top of all this, we've got she happens to not really be able to use powers, which is pretty delightful in the very beginning of this book.
Okay, give us a brief overview, because it really is such a good opening.
So we left you last week with No Rest for the Wicked, with a very, very happy and happily ever aftered Sebastian and Cadran. And but somebody was left in eternal flame. Bowen, our werewolf friend, was left in a burning tunnel, right? It's a tunnel, right?
Yeah, he deserved it, though.
He did. He was a jerk.
He was such a
and
jerk.
So he was left in this tunnel, and inside a tomb where, as part of the Amazing Race. So the Amazing Race is still going on. One of the things that we talked about a couple of weeks ago was that Cressley does this really cool thing where she is currently, she writes concurrent books. So this book, the last book, the next book, and I want to say one more, are all concurrent. So they will all happen at the same time and relate in some way to the Amazing Race. Actually, the next book may probably won't, but there is another Amazing Race book in the mix.
Right, because the Demon Brothers kind of come back.
Exactly. And so what's happening is, so we've lost, the Amazing Race has completed, we've seen who wins because that happened last book, and now here we are, and the characters who are stuck in this tomb, who were competing and are now sort of in the tomb together, will ultimately obviously not win because we know how the whole thing turns out. And here we are in a tomb. And Bowen, the werewolf, desperately wants to win the Amazing Race because, if you'll remember from last week, the prize for the Amazing Race is a key that will turn back time. And he has a mate who he's lost. And we start to realize that werewolves, we know werewolves have a single fated mate. And we know that the loss of a mate is so profound for werewolves that they literally can't go on usually. But Bowen, we are told, or made to believe, is so strong that he has somehow been able to survive without his mate, despite the fact that she died on a full moon running from his beast, which is super traumatic.
I mean, 200 years worth of trauma.
Yeah. And so he spent 200 years sort of riddled with guilt about her death, trying to imagine what an immortal life would be like without a mate. And finally, he has access to a chance to turn back time and save her. Except he loses the Amazing Race. He doesn't get access to this key. The High. I should call it the High, not the Amazing Race.
I just thought of something interesting, which is for 200 years, he's been what he thinks is sort of like wasting away. But Mariketta, you're going to hopefully talk about this in a minute. She curses him. And then he's like, for really the whole book with Catarin, like we know this, he's literally wasting away. Like, now he knows what it is. And I think that's like really interesting. Like, she's really there's like nothing left of him, right? She's just peeling layers and layers and layers back until he is just this she really strips him down.
Sure. And she pisses him off, and he leaves her locked in a tomb with a bunch of people, a bunch of other immortals, and a handful of incubi who want to die, who literally want to die. And
yeah, it's really scary.
Yeah, and it's terrifying because they're horrible beings who could easily kill her. They're trapped in an enchanted tomb. They can't get out. None of these immortals can get out. And and they would be fine, except Maraketta, as we've pointed out, is not yet immortal. But luckily, she's cursed our werewolf friend, Bowen, and he can only survive if he returns to the scene of his crime and opens the tomb again and saves her, which he does. And then they are trapped in a subtropical jungle for a long time.
Weeks.
Trying to get out. And they fall in love.
She kicks his ass.
Yeah, but she puts him through the ringer, and it is delightful.
Absolutely.
Delightful.
I loved rereading this one. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've loved rereading them all, but this one, it was a real pleasure to, after last time kind of feeling so sad and emotional, this time around instead feeling the power, right? She is nothing but she's just 100% power. And I loved that.
And that's the key here. We have a special guest today, which we're going to talk about, and who we'll introduce, and you'll get to hear her talk. But one of the things that comes up in the conversation that you're about to hear is that this really is the beginning of Cressley's heroine heyday. I mean, here we start to see a Cressley Cole heroine just come into her own. And I feel like Maraketta is the beginning of what Cressley will do over the course of the series with heroines. And part of the reason why I am so enjoying, and I think I enjoyed this book on the reread in 2018 even more than the prior two, is that Maraketta's strength is so important. And also, I just desire this kind of strength in a heroine these days. And I think she's so incredibly good at creating, as Cressley is so good at creating alphas, period. And here she is sort of building up this alpha heroine. And I just can't think of a time ever in my romance reading life where I've wanted alpha heroines more than right now.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So this scratched my itch in a big way this week.
Well, and to think that this book is 12 years old, right? And the power of Maraketta is still really unparalleled means we all need to do better. Okay. So last June, I was at RWA and met up with Adriana Herrera. She is will be coming out with her debut romance novel. She'll tell us about it in spring of 2019. And she and I sat down and at lunch one day, and we got involved in a really fascinating conversation about domestic violence in romance. And we ended up, she agreed to essentially let me interview her for a piece that was published at the Smart Bitches that we'll link to in the show notes, because I think it's a really amazing read. And she just has, Adriana works in trauma, she works in social work, and the resources she has at her disposal for understanding this. It was a fascinating conversation and really changed the way I think about romance and what, when I read a character who has a traumatic past, what I expect the author to do to sort of make that right. So in our chatting, it turns out that she is an Immortals After Dark fan. And I asked her if she would be on our podcast, and she was really excited. And even better is I asked her, like, we kind of asked people what book they'd like to talk about. And she, without even thinking about it, I mean, I think she texted back immediately. I would have had to look up the title. She knew exactly which one she wanted, and it was this one. So we're really excited to have her as our first guest. Oh, it's a fascinating conversation where she talks about girl power versus feminism, women's ability to heal ourselves from trauma, and why Bowen is the ultimate fuckboy.
So welcome, Adriana.
Tell us about yourself and your writing, and then maybe you can segue into why this is the book you wanted to discuss.
My debut novel's coming out in March. It's a gay romance. I don't necessarily consider myself a just gay romance author, but that's just happens to be the first book I wrote. It's called American Dreamer, and it's coming out with Carina Press in March. And it's a story about Ernesto Vasquez. He's a Dominican entrepreneur who's taking his Afro-Caribbean food truck to Ithaca to try to make it a success in upstate New York, and falls in love with a shy but very, like, sharp-tongued librarian. So
I love a food truck romance.
I know. It's kind of cute. I'm biased, but I think it's pretty good.
That's how I met Adriana. Was I was at a signing at Strand, right? That's where we met.
That's right.
And you came up to me after, and we were just talking, and then you said, I'm writing a food truck romance, and I lost my mind. Yes. And I'm so, so excited for this book, and I cannot wait.
If you parked a food truck inside a salt circle, you could Sarah McLean into it right away.
I mean, I feel like in this one, she would want to stay there.
Oh, I absolutely would.
Yes.
Adriana, tell us how you got to IAD. How did you come to find the series, read the series, love the series?
So I came to Cressa Cole, interestingly enough, because of her historical romance.
Interesting.
Yes. So, and surprisingly enough, I was actually, like, at that point obsessed with paranormal. That was all I was reading. But I was, like, taking a break.
And did you know that she had written IAD? Or was this, like, at 2006? Like, are you an original?
No, I actually looked this up, and I was living in Ethiopia when I read the first few books. This was like in 2009.
What were you doing in Ethiopia, can I ask?
So I worked in humanitarian relief organizations. My partner and I did that work overseas for about 7 years, and 5 of those years we lived in Ethiopia. So the Kindle was literally a miracle that happened in my life in 2008, because instead of bringing a suitcase full of books to Ethiopia with me every year when we came home, I could just download books into my Kindle.
Oh, that's amazing. And so you were reading paranormal in, like, the heyday of paranormal. So you were reading, like, J.R. Ward and Janine Frost and Lindsay Sands and
Karen Marie Monet, Ilona Andrews, like all these, Patricia Briggs, like all those books that were coming out back then. And I hadn't discovered her until after I read her, like, the McCarrick Brothers trilogy, which is, like, one of my favorite historical romance series ever.
And it should be, because it's delicious.
Oh, my goodness.
And also really fascinating, because it's, first of all, you can see, like, the heartbeat of IAD in that series.
Right,
like, the
right.
Scottish, her love of Scotsmen.
Yes.
And also the themes are all sort of very similar, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, her men are very similar. And I think those three guys especially have, like, a real essence to, like, the men that she has in the IAD series. I like Bowen especially, if I can talk about my favorite, one of my favorite fuckboys. He's not my favorite because my favorite is Lothair, who's everybody's favorite fuckboy.
Oh, I know.
Yes. Yes. He's my favorite fuckboy for sure.
Well,
he's that man that you had to cut loose 5 years ago, but is still in your mom's phone family plan.
Oh, God, that's so real.
It really is who he is. He left you unread 5 years ago, and yet he's still in your mom's family plan.
I'm just cackling over here because that's so real. Okay, but you can come back and talk about Lothair later. Let's talk about Bowen. So this was the book that you were like, that's the one I want to talk about. So is it because of Bowen?
It's because it was so vivid to me. Like, I think I remember reading that book where I was, and I remember thinking, this is so fun.
Yeah, well, and also it feels like you were far away from home, and this book is far away from home.
Yes, yes.
Oh, I love it when books find you. Isn't that the best?
And I was working a lot in the field back then, like in rural Ethiopia. So I was like reading a lot of these like novels and like, you know, no power, no electricity, like sometimes in like not the best hotels. So I was like very much like in the wilderness when I was reading a lot of these. So I just remember kind of that time reading this series and thinking like, this is just like pure escapism. Like I'm just like going away with these books. But with this one specifically, I just thought it was so clever. Like the premise, like she starts back then, like The Amazing Race was still very popular. And that's kind of like how the book starts.
Well, and we talked last week about, or last time, about how this is a book that also just adds like a layer, right? So in the first book, we get Sebastian and Catherine and a lot more of The Amazing Race. And this one, we get sort of the beginning and him trapping them into this terrible cave.
Yes.
And so it's really like a story. We kind of know how this is going to end. And when, you know, when he traps them in there, we know that he himself is going to be trapped somewhere for a couple weeks and that this misery is not going to be over anytime soon. So that really adds this layer of like dread as a reader.
Yeah.
Where you're just like, oh no, Bowen, you're going to regret this.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think like, and also, I mean, what I love about this heroine in particular is that she like is always saving herself. Mm-hmm. In ways that are like so powerful. Like I really, and I mean, reading, going back to it, like I just read it over the last couple weeks. First, I was like thrown by how young she was. I didn't remember yes. her being so young. I was like, shit, 23. I could barely like figure out my like building laundry machine when I was 23. But going back, like what I really liked about them was that tit for tat, although she has that in every book, like every mm-hmm. heroine is like very tit for tat with the heroes. Like they're not like one upped. But with her, I really liked how she was just like so resilient.
I think one of the things I found, like last time we talked about Catherine and how it was about emotions, right? Like the depth of her feeling for her lost sisters. Mm-hmm. And this one, it's really all exploring a female power, because Mariketa is a literal powerhouse. Mm-hmm. She doesn't really know what to do with her power, but she is just power in pure, undiluted form. And I loved that. I like reading about Catherine again kind of made me sad at times. Reading Mariketa made me want to go out and kick somebody's ass.
Yeah. And she was, I mean, one of the things that I find interesting about this series, and I always, you know, like I'm always like looking for that piece of kind of like societal complications, and the world she's like given us has a lot of like discrimination, prejudices within the different types of immortals, right? So there's like the werewolves and the witches hate each other, and there's all this like prejudice against the witches from like all of the lore. So it's there's a lot of that. And I really like the fact that Mariketa like really called Bowen out on that. Like really made him like see his prejudice. And like, mm-hmm. you're like playing yourself, essentially. Like you are creating, like you keep doing this and you're playing yourself because you know that we're going to end up together. So what are you going to do about all this like hate that you've like kind of just like let sit there? And I really liked about that about her, that she was young, but she was like really willing to kind of like go there.
You know, I think that's so interesting because when I was rereading this last week, I was thinking over and over again that I'm not sure that I read this book with the same. I know I didn't read this book. I haven't read this series with the same lens before as I am now, sort of in 2018.
Right.
And I feel like it really is resonating for me in an incredibly powerful way now mm-hmm. on the reread. And part of this book particularly, what I love about it is Mariketa's willingness to call Bowen out, and then also her sort of unabashed desire to stand in her own power.
Yeah.
And yes. refusing to let him save her. because she's just fine, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the thing that was, it's funny because if with every hero, it's funny you called him a fuckboy. The thing that I, like, made me really furious at him was his insistence that she could just, like, not practice magic. And when she says to him finally, like, oh, so you're going to stop hunting and running in the night?
Right, right.
Like, and that, I don't know, that really resonated with me, like, in 2018, for sure, this idea that a man could just assume something so vitally important to a woman could just be left behind at his order.
Well, and he does it again and again. He does it when he comes to get her and he brings her her toiletries and her vibrator, right? Yes. Her lipstick. And then he throws it in the river because he says she doesn't need it. And then there's the moment where he tries to take her birth control.
Yes.
And she's like, no, no. And I was like, oh, no.
I mean, the thing about these books, right? Like, these books are 12 years old, right?
Yeah.
This was, like, pretty brazen for a woman to be writing into a romance novel. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was, like, I mean, a lot of what she did, I felt like it was just very empowering, and especially for women that age, you know, like thinking about a 23-year-old woman reading that and thinking that, like, no, I do need that vibrator. Thank you very much. And the birth control.
Yeah. And on top of it, like, with unabashed sex positivity, there's no moment in this book where Mariquetta isn't absolutely proud of her past. She had a boyfriend for 5 years. He was a demon. It was great.
They had great sex. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's no, and what I love about that, especially coming off of Cressley being a historical writer, right, where in historicals, so much of this is just sort of stagnated. The sort of virginity as a construct virginity is so prized in historicals so often that this idea that Mariquetta would say, virginity is a construct, go fuck yourself, is remarkable.
Well, and not only that, but there's all these scenes where they're like, right, like you think they're going to have sex and then he screws it up and she's like, get out of here. But that, and it was funny because I had not read, I'm rereading it again and I was kind of like, oh, are we going to get a replay of A Hunger Like No Other where, you know, it's the full moon and, you know, he can't hold himself back. And instead, it's this amazing scene where she uses her power to immobilize him. And I found it again, like the insistence over and over again that she knew her mind, she knew her body, she doesn't know how to control her powers, but she knows it's important. I found her to be a really remarkable heroine. And this especially struck me that it's the first book where the heroine's not a Valkyrie. There's no Valkyries in this book. And, you know, that's kind of a big transition then in the series, that you're going to blow out this world and introduce us to a whole new group of immortals that we don't really know that well. That's a dangerous moment, I think, in a series.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think Mariquetta, like, kind of because, like, Mariquetta is, like, on the cusp of, like, really, like, unleashing all this power into this world, right? So she's, like, a real catalyst for, like, I think, like, I feel like she really kind of, like, shaped, I feel like, a lot of the dynamics for the heroines in the series. I mean, at least that's how I felt. Like, I felt, maybe that's why I remembered her so well. Because, like, she really stuck out to me as, like, a really different heroine than maybe the ones that I had read up until then in paranormal romance.
Yeah, she's like the primordial, you know, heroine of IAD. I think you're right. And I think, you know, we've talked about how A Hunger Like No Other is the first book of the series, but No Rest for the Wicked, which is book two, is really the first book where we start to see what Cressley was envisioning for the series. And I think this book might be, you may have hit on this idea that this book might be the first time we really see, like, what a heroine in Cressley Cole's hands can be.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that made her really intriguing and compelling to me is the fact that she has her own dark past, right? Like, usually in the paranormal romance, like, you have the dark hero, right? But like Mary Kate has like a very sad story. Like she feels like she was left by her parents. She's like alone in this quest to like figure out how she's gonna control this power that could be like the destruction for her world. Like she has like a real, like it's like usually the hero's journey, right? Like this like enormous responsibility.
And she's not willing to turn her back on it.
No, right. And she's like looking to figure it out on her own. Like willing to take the risk of whatever it is that she's gonna find on the other side of that mirror. Like she's doing it on her own.
Sarah, you were saying earlier that you were looking at like how many times apples were used. I think there's a lot of symbolism in here. And Adriana just mentioned the mirrors. So why do you think that we get this like sort of intensifying of this like symbolic nature of like the apples and the mirrors? Like, what do you, as a writer, I was sort of curious what the two of you might think about that.
I don't think I noticed on the first read at all the symbolism. And now, of course, I can't stop thinking of Snow White, right? And it's clearly Snow White is the allegory here. There's this, you know, who's the fairest when we sort of get to the end of the book and you sort of it unpeel it peels back the sort of the evil witch, the god. She's not a goddess. She's a, what is she, a sorceress?
Hexa?
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess the three, there's three of them, this like triumvirate of witches, right? Hecate and Hexa and
Yes.
the one that's always good, the one that's always bad, and the one that is both, right? And Hexa is always bad. And so you sort of have this moment of this kind of like maleficent-y feel, right? Of this character, except so the apples, I mean, the sort of apple as knowledge, apple as temptation, apple as it's all there, obviously. But for me, the Snow White was really present. And for me also, I had this moment where I was like, oh, wait, this is a Cressley, this is sort of it's a fingerprint of Cressley's, this kind of Disney connection.
Oh, interesting. Say more about that.
Because it comes back again and again.
That is really fascinating. And now that you say it, I can totally see it.
Sure. And right up until, and this is sort of spoiling the future a little bit, but when we get to Wicked Abyss, the heroine literally works at Disney.
Yeah.
Doesn't Cressley live in Florida? Is this
She does.
is this a Florida thing?
And you know what, now that you're saying that, like I always think about the Valkyries and like that like sorority girl kind of like feel that they have. Like I always imagine them as like this like kind of like band of like college girls, like out of like the Clueless movie or something.
I think that's how you're supposed to.
I think so
I'm with you.
too. And you want to secretly join them. Well, here's the thing though, the mirror part to me is like a nod to like the sorority girl thing, right? Like women who look at themselves in the mirror too much are vain and are like think too highly of themselves. They're too worried about the wrong things, right? Like you get punished by society for being too vain, too beautiful, right? So the fact that she's the queen of reflections. I just thought that there, I constantly am impressed at the way that Cressley is essentially like reclaiming the things that are used against sort of femininity or womanhood or right sort of like the gender essentialism for women. And I think it's like a reclaiming of it. Like women can be trapped by those expectations too. And I thought there was something really powerful. I found myself thinking a lot about mirrors and what the role they play in our lives. And I just, I don't know. It was very contemplative for me.
Yeah, and I think I like that point of like that we can really be really trapped, and at the end of the day, like only we can really like liberate ourselves from it as well. Because I really appreciated that even at the end when, you know, Bowen kind of like had to go there and kind of like ask her to come back to him, it was very much like she was in control. You know, like it wasn't like him like kind of like snatching her back, but it was like her kind of like letting go and like understanding the importance that she had in his life. And she wasn't willing to be anything but the most important thing. I always think about trauma when I'm reading books because I work in trauma. And I really like loved how she built like that piece of like her like the like she repaired the how the attachment with her parents, like that brokenness of her and losing her parents, and how like she repaired that for her in like really significant ways. Like I always look for like the viability of how this repair, like the reparations work in these stories, because sometimes it's like, no, that person's never gonna get over this, like that's not gonna work. But I felt like she did a really lovely job of like really repairing that bond for her and like really creating a viable, like happily ever after for her.
And a community of people. You know, we've talked before about this idea of sort of found family. And I love, one of the things I love the most about this book is that there's this kind of merry band with them the whole time. There are the two demons who are about to become heroes of future books. There are the elves who are with them. When she gets trapped, when they all get trapped in the cave together at the very start of the book, or the tomb together at the very start of the book, she's not alone. She's with people, and she's with people who like care about her, surprisingly, right? I mean, they're strangers and they've been competing with each other. And I feel like they too, this band of people are a piece of how she does heal.
Yeah, the resilience.
Well, and she literally heals herself. I mean, every time she's injured.
God, I love those. The magnificent IV visuals, yes. Yeah. Are so beautiful.
Yes.
And I had not really remembered that, but this time around, I was so moved by it. The whole idea that you have to heal yourself. I mean, it just is so, it was really beautiful to me.
And from nature, right? Like from nature, like she had to lay and let the earth like heal her. I thought it was just like a beautiful symbolism of women and like our bodies.
Yeah. I mean, I also think that one of the most powerful things that kept coming back to me during the reread on this was the fact that he never saves her. She is always the sort of formative savior. And what I mean by that is, you know, right at the very start, you think, oh God, she's locked in this tomb with these other people and it's terrible and he has to come back and save her. But the reason why he has to come back and save her is because she's cursed him. Right. She is the catalyst for his saving her constantly, right through to that bonkers scene with the gorillas in the jungle.
I had repressed all that scene, right? Where she's
totally
like,
totally forgot that scene.
You're not going to survive this.
It's, I know, bonkers. Have you guys seen Jack Ryan on Amazon?
No.
Well, it's this John Krasinski show on Amazon, and their first episode is very similar. One of the early episodes is very similar to this, where like they're in a bunker and like they have to, people just like blow up an entire field of soldiers to get to one man like in the bunker. And I felt like this time I was like, this is mental, what's happening here.
It's honestly, I will tell you, I mostly am a reader. I don't really watch TV. I do like going to the movies, though, but my favorite genre of movie, I tell my students this all the time, is handsome men blow things up.
Yeah, well, and that's what this is.
Yeah, I just want to see action movie.
Except it's better because he's also a werewolf who's just like will tear through anybody, anything to get to her. And she's the reason why. Like, again, she's the catalyst. She's his mate. She is the one who is, she's summoning him and she knows she's summoning him. And like, she loses any sense of trepidation, right? Because in this context, right? Like, she knows that it's the first full moon since they met. She knows that they're mated now. She knows what's coming. And there's a very real sense with Cressley always with her heroes and heroines that like, sex is going to come. It's going to be fantastic, but it's also going to be like, it's going to change them forever. And there's no going back. And that's a very clear hallmark of a Cressley Cole novel. And in this particular case, like, I love the moment where she's like hiding in the woods or in the jungle. And then these people come upon her and they're the bad guys. And she's basically like, you're making a terrible mistake. And they take her anyway. And she's like, fine, have it your way. He's coming.
I love the moment where he's essentially at the metal door. Yes. And there's this pause.
Yeah.
And she knows it's because he doesn't want her to see him that way.
Yeah. Oh, it's magnificent.
And I mean, the one of the moments in this book to me that was like when like he double downs on his fuckboyness and calls her Mariah.
Oh, you guys, I gasped.
I had blocked that out from the first reading, apparently. And
me too.
Calls her the wrong name.
Did not just do that. And like the thing about her that I love, it's like she's like, no, like you need to do better. Like this is over. Like this sex was just amazing. But you need to get yourself together.
I couldn't believe she forgave him. I was like, I'm going to need you to put him in cold storage for several weeks.
Several weeks.
Well, and I love how
you talk to him again.
Especially because his excuse is like, well, it's been like 200 years of me not thinking of anybody else. It's like, I don't care, dude.
Yeah.
I love it. It's it's a magnificent way of revealing a hero's... Cressley never... ever lets up on heroes. They are flawed. Their flaws stay with them, you know, long after I think lesser authors would let go of them. I mean, I include myself in that. I feel like I never commit to heroes' flaws the way Cressley does. And it's what makes the books terrific.
It really brings out, like, and I just said something really, I think, like, key in the like 0.5 episode when I was listening to it, when you talked about these heroines, which are modern and empowered and full of like feminist values. And then these like tired, immortal, like weary men, and like how like she's just like clashing that over and over again in these stories, like just confronting those two worlds, right? And then, like, it truly is that new blood really kind of brings out a new man, like a man that can, like, live up to this woman that has, like, called him out on his bullshit and read him for filth through an entire book.
You know what's funny, though? At some point, I said I thought that Fury, right? Like, Sarah and I are both convinced that Fury is going to get pulled out of the bottom of the ocean, right? That I was like, I think that, what's Josephine's brother's name?
Thad
or something. I was like, I think it's going to be Fury and Thad. And Sarah was like, you're ridiculous. He's too young.
It
and I was
can't like, be.
I understand that, but I want us all to have a moment where we examine that is our internalized sexism. If these young modern women can fix these exhausted men, why is it that the opposite just seems ridiculous?
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm just going to put that out there, right? Because I feel the same way.
It's because I want to hold Thad in my, like, warm bosom and, like, cook him pasta. That's why.
All right. I'm just saying many episodes from now are going to discuss this. But, like, I just think there's something really interesting this is who we think will fix, exhausted men.
Yeah.
But furious, angry women cannot be fixed by, like, young football players.
I feel like a young body could fix a lot of problems.
Oh, yeah. For a lady, like, for sure she could have some fun.
Oh. Oh, my God.
And scene, right?
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, but it's, like, it's an interesting thread, right? And I think it's, like, speaking to the craft that you have mentioned before, Sarah, and we're mentioning today. It's, like, I think reading her books is really, like, a masterclass in how you, like, build and build and build and build on stakes until that you're literally breathless.
Mm-hmm. There's a fearlessness to it.
Yes.
And I don't know how you get that. Maybe you do.
Yeah, I mean, it just has to be like an extreme amount of discipline of saying, I am letting myself do this, you know?
Yeah.
Because it truly is like remarkable the level to which she takes us in these stories. And it's like, there's no way this is going to work out. Like, he has no eye. And she's trapped like with like a lot of succubi.
Yeah.
Right.
And she... There's never a moment in the whole series where that isn't mm-hmm. Cressley's like driving force. I mean, it begins with a man gnawing off his leg, mm-hmm. right? Like mm-hmm. this is the bar. That's ground zero of Immortals After Dark.
I was like, this is the third book in a row, everybody, where someone loses a limb. And I was like, oh, man, again, I sent Sarah a text. I was like, she doesn't have a leg right now? Are you kidding me?
Maybe that's a metaphor for something. I don't know what. We'll get there.
There's a lot of limbs that go missing in this series.
I think it's, you know what, though? Like, I do think it's a metaphor. And I think it's about how you have to, you have to, like, reassemble yourself for love.
Yeah. Like, literally rip shit out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, like, you literally have to, and, like, come with all your baggage and just start tearing stuff off if you're gonna make it work. And it does feel like that big. And I think it's just like a really, I think that's why it's so relatable. And that's kind of also like the great thing about paranormal romance, right? Like there's like no holds barred, like none, like you can just let yourself sink into these like insane stories. And it's like, yep, I'm in it, because everything is like, the stakes are like huge from the get-go. Like nobody dies. There's like 70 types of different person. Like,
right. Well, I actually think that's why I'm really fascinated by the, it's the incubi who pay Marichetta to, mm-hmm. to kill them. Mm-hmm. Because we are getting, you know, we've had a couple books now where the immortals will do anything to stay alive. And then to have this reminder that that also means that eternal torture really lasts forever, and that an immortal can wish for it to be over. I think that's like a really important sort of like signpost she's giving us. Like the accession is here, characters are going to die, loved ones are going to, but that there's still danger for them. Like, you know, high stakes is, the stakes are even higher when you can live forever. And I thought that was just like a really interesting, I don't know, like part of this story, this like immortals, they're going to pay her, right, to kill them.
Yeah. Well, and it's also so heartbreaking, which is a very weird feeling to have after you've watched these incubi, these creatures torture her, you know, and everybody else in the cave for weeks, right? You have this moment of real sympathy for them.
Yeah. And which the fact is that she was weird. Able to give them, like, have that mercy for them, right?
Yeah. I mean, she's so, it's just another piece of her just being incredibly strong. But also, I would say, it's the first time that we see the witches as mercenaries. In the sense that they literally pay her, right? They give her the golden mm-hmm. headdress as payment for her mm-hmm. service. And she thinks to herself, like, this headdress means something because it's my first payment for my right. work. And I had a moment where I was thinking to myself, I had this moment about just sort of the world at large and how, you know, we place such value on women's, on work and on the job, the breadwinner. And women have for so long not had access to that. And we place such little value on women's work, quote. And so there's really interesting interplay here with the Valkyries being so consumed by money and jewels mm-hmm. and like and riches and the best of things, and the witches being workers and like wanting to be paid for their skill. And I think and the expectation that they should be paid for their skill and well. And I love that. Because again, it's that sort of unapologetic.
And it's interesting, right? Because I was like, I was thinking when you said that, I was thinking about Cardi B, who I love. Mm-hmm. And thinking about like, she just came out with this song called Money. And all she talks about is like, she likes a lot of things, but mostly she likes money. I was born to flex. Yes. Diamonds on my neck. I like boarding jets. I like morning sex. But nothing in this world that I like more than checks. Money. All I really want to see is the money. I don't really need to be any the money. All a bad bitch need is the money. I got pants in the coupe. And I'm thinking like, I can get with that. Like, it's not really my brand, but I really kind of like appreciate like someone saying, I work for this and I like to get paid a lot for it.
Yeah, I deserve it.
I deserve it. And it's like the idea that women are always like sneaky or like that, you know, like we want that money, that we want the shiny, and it's somehow like we don't deserve it.
Or that it makes us
vain
or silly or foolish. And yet Bowen has so much money that he can rent them an island off the coast of Belize for 2 weeks at the drop of a hat.
Oh yeah, that's nice,
right? Oh, that's I would like that.
That was nice.
I know, I would like that.
He does like manage to kind of like, it's like so funny how he keeps messing up because he has really great ideas.
the spirit is willing.
I think he's a really fascinating character. You know, we've talked a lot about Marquetta, and I didn't like, I think Bowen just kept screwing up time and time again, but there's a point at which he decides, I'm going to keep working for this. I'm going to keep trying.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I found that very, I don't know. Like I appreciated that she was working really hard. He was working really hard too.
Something that really made me kind of sad for him and also made me think about also the traps that men are in. And the when he talks about his old maid who turned out to be like, you know, a really bad person, he was talking about how like she wanted to change him, right? So it was like she was like telling him that he needed to be less beastly, and that like at one point she said something like, my goal is kind of like to tame you or something like that. And then like part of what like he really loved about Marquetta is that she wanted all of it. But thinking about like the traps also like of like men and expectations and like needing to like feel like you need to be a certain type of like masculinity, right? Like all these different like mixed signals that we get about like what's masculinity.
Well, and I think one thing that I liked is there's explicitly a part where Heath talks about Lachlan, and what he essentially realizes is Lachlan is able to get over, right? He loves Emma's bite. He wears it proudly now. And he sort of, it's like if Lachlan can change and grow, I can too. Mm-hmm. And I ended up really liking that idea that masculinity, that positive role models for men are urgent and important. Like Mark, she doesn't need that the same way he does. She knows who he is, but there's something about that relationship with Lachlan that helps him move on and figure out how to do that.
Yeah, because he's happy. Like he sees his cousin or his other cousin, right? Mm-hmm. He sees them like really happy and joyful, and it's like, I want that. Like if that has a cost, I feel like I'm willing to pay it.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because I just realized this whole series is very much about a desire for the mate, right? Which again is not an ordinary romance. That doesn't happen in most romances. Mm-hmm. In romance, we often see the hero who is resistant to mm-hmm. matehood, is resistant to love, is resistant to, you know, partnership. The man, you know, on the island. But that's not what these heroes are. These heroes know that they are less heroic without a partner.
Yeah.
And I sort of love that.
Yeah, she really proposes. I mean, the thinking about when this series started and the kind of paranormal romance that was coming out then, which was very exciting and very like the girl power thing was definitely there. But I always make a very big distinction between girl power and feminism. I don't think they're the same thing. Girl power to me is like the Disney version of feminism. Like feminism actually goes to the hard stuff, like oppression and like taking a look at the systems that are like oppressing and like breaking down and dismantling them and coming up with something new that works for everybody, right? And girl power is about like girls rule, equality, but it's and feminism is like equity. It's like a level playing field. And I think about that, and when I was reading this book, and I try to look at it, right? Because when I read this book before, I hadn't taken the deep dive into feminism that I have over the last like 8 years. And when I'm reading it again, I'm thinking about the fact that Marigueta's not just looking for, like, I'm a girl and you need to treat me right. She's like, no, you need to change yourself. You need to change your perceptions about the kind of person I am, about my kind. And you need to come to me right and change yourself. Like, I feel like that is a little bit, like, more profound than just saying, like, you know, you and I should be the same or whatever. Like, it's like you need to change too.
Well, I think that's also the power. It's internal for her, but the prophecy at work, right? So it's foretold that a male of the lore will sort of try and shut her down or like mm-hmm. whatever. And I think it's a verbalizing of like our feminine instincts or right? Like she has this constant reminder that she has bigger things in store for her than just being Bowen's mate.
Right.
And I think that to me was like very profound, that her like time and time and time again, she insists that she be herself.
Yeah.
And that never got old for me. I loved that. It shows that that's like a constant battle she has to go through or like a part of the daily life of maybe of her as a woman, but that she is committed to that course of action. And therefore she knows like kind of, you know, there's like a North Star for her mm-hmm. and she is just always going to be pointing towards it. And great if Bowen wants to point the same way with her.
Yeah. Like her calling is something bigger than trying to figure out how to be with him.
And Cressley delivers on that promise, right? And I at the beginning of the book, you're sort of told about the prophecy and you're told that she's the awaited, right? She has this sense of responsibility to the coven and to immortals and to the world. But from a craft perspective, it's all well and good as a writer to say like, okay, well, she's the awaited one and she has responsibility to the world, but you have to be able to deliver to the reader this piece. And what Cressley gives her is access to all the knowledge in the world, right? Mm-hmm. So much knowledge, so much understanding, so much empathy, so much emotion that she literally, once she is pulled away from that mirror, eventually at the end of the book, the rest of the coven, witches from around the world, have to come together to bind her powers mm-hmm. so that she doesn't get herself trapped again by all the knowledge in the world because she's too new with power. And I think that is really, I mean, again, it goes back to this thing that we've talked about already about Cressley doesn't hesitate to just lean right in. But like that, when given the option between like this werewolf who's great lay and
right.
all the knowledge in the world. Like, of course, we're in a position where he is, I don't want to say secondary, but like, he has to, as you said, Adriana, like, he has to come up and stand with her. Like, he has to stand next to her knowing that he will never be all of that. And he's going to have to feel okay with that.
Yeah. Like, he's complimentary. Like, he makes her life so much better, but he is not like her, like, the duties that she has and the responsibilities have to be bigger than trying to make herself into, like, the maid that he...
Yeah, it's a really bold choice. It's super modern. I can't think of really any romance novel. I mean, like, I would have to sort of really sit down and think to come up with a book before this where that's the structure.
I don't think I can think of one. And I was trying to think about it a little bit when I was reading this, because I was thinking, how many books, not now that I've like literally like spent the last 8 years like in profound study of like feminist theory, that I can read and not throw across the room. And this one, like I kept thinking, oh no, this is gonna make me not want to be able to read it. And I read it and I really enjoyed it, and it really made me think. It really made me think of her. And like, also, I think the challenge for myself of having to be like, no, this works for her. Like, would I be that? Would I do it the same? Maybe not. Maybe I would have really like had to take him off my mom's family plan after he called Mariah's name.
After he tried to take your birth control.
Right. But I think that that's really, truly like the craft that she has. And I think, well, it's so wonderful that you guys are doing this podcast to really kind of like analyze her writing a little bit deeply, because I think like she's done some really ballsy stuff in her heroines that like really like rereads well, like it stands the test of time well. Like, these books are like 11 years old.
Right, which in romance is like might as well be 1,000
years
old.
It's a generation, yeah.
You know, there's like here and there, there's like consent pieces that I wasn't like, oh yeah, like I don't know if that would fly if it came out this year. You know what I'm saying? But it was like nothing major. I mean, given when it was written, I felt like there was one point where he's like, she's like, I think sleeping, and he's like, touches her.
Right.
And I was like, maybe that, like, but otherwise, I felt like it was pretty good. And it's been a while. Like, the conversation about consent has gone a lot further since then.
Well, and I think that's partly because she's so strong. She is so strong. I mean, and we've talked a lot about this, that, you know, there are heroes I like of Cressley's that I feel great about. I love her heroines. And they're all so different from each other. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like she's really writing the same heroine over and over again.
No.
I feel like there's these differences between them that make them very compelling and interesting to me.
I like her women. Like, Nyx is one of my favorite all-time characters.
Well, yeah. Yes. I mean,
yeah. Like, she's perfect. Any series.
Do you think she'll be a good heroine, though, when she's, like, the star of her own book?
I don't know. I've been wanting it since the first, like, time I read her. Like, read her character. I'm like, her book is going to be... But as that series evolved, like, I feel like, she's maybe bigger than, like, a love story. Like, I think maybe she's one of those, like, tragic, like, lone figures, almost.
Yeah, Nyx's book wins the Pulitzer.
Or it's just the last one,
or it's
right?
Just like the this, last one.
It's just if there's a last book, it's got to be Nyx's.
Well, something has to talk about a requirement for an evolution. I think for sure Nyx has to evolve, and we're starting to see Nyx evolve in the books. By the time we get to, you know, a year from now, when we get to the end of this series, we're starting to see her change. But also, I would say as I've said before, there is never a moment in these books where I can see where Cressley is going. And so I would say that if anybody can pull off Nyx as heroine,
yes,
it's Cressley.
Yeah, I mean, and I mean, like, she's been with her now for 20 books almost. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I'd read it, of course, like, that night.
Yeah, immediately. Midnight download. Don't talk to me. Adriana, this was amazing. And I'm so glad that you joined us.
It was so fun, guys. I was looking forward to it for weeks, and it really lived up to my...
Yay! We felt the same way.
We are so excited to have you, and we are so excited to read American Dreamer, which is coming in the spring.
Yep, March, from Carina Press. I assume that, like, I'm going to have copies to distribute soon. So I'll put... I have Twitter. I'm on Twitter, La Adriana Herrera, and my website is AdrianaHerreraRomance.com. So I will have updates there.
Great. And we will put all of that into show notes. And will you come back and talk to us again about other books?
Yes. If you don't find other people to talk about any of the other 18 books, you know where to find me.
Are you going to reread the whole series again right now?
I mean, I have to.
Well, we have to.
Yeah. So that was amazing.
As our first guest, we are both, I think, really nervous, but Adriana, like, can come back anytime.
Yeah. And also, I mean, she clearly has opinions about Lothair, and I know she and everyone in the whole world have opinions about Lothair. So we'll have to do, like, a special mashup episode where everybody just tells us what they think about Lothair.
That is an amazing idea.
We actually really should do that. That's incredible. So that was Wicked Deeds on a Winter's Night, Bowen and Mariquetta's story. And Bowen and Mariquetta will join us again. Mariquetta, obviously, as Mariquetta the Awaited, she's coming back again and again. She's got superpowers, and they are going to need to be used during this session. But next week, we're going to take a little bit of a turn. We are going into the vampire world. We're going back to the Roth brothers.
Right. And the title of the next book is Dark Needs at Night's Edge. And it has a polarizing heroine, at least among our Twitter friends.
Yeah, I don't know why, because I love her.
I love her, too.
So the heroine is, we get to meet a ghost. It's ghosts next week in Monster Mash.
Oh, yes.
So we're back with the Roths. We are with Conrad Roth, who is the third brother, the third of the Roth brothers. And Conrad's in a place, y'all. He is detoxing.
Chained to a bed.
He is chained to a bed, which is my favorite kind of hero. And
me too. Same.
And he is detoxing from the fact that he has been drinking from the vein, which we know is no bueno. But luckily he's chained to a bed in like a haunted house, but haunted by a delightful ballerina ghost
that he falls in love with.
God, I love it.
And we at least did too.
I know. I love it. That's so bonkers. Jesus, Cressley, why are you so crazy?
I love it. I love it too.
I never want her to change. So yeah, there's a ballerina ghost and a vampire chained to a bed, and it gets weird, and I love every minute of it. So don't forget to join us 2 weeks from today for the read-along of Dark Needs at Night's Edge. And don't forget to join us next week for our mini episode where we talk about something fun.
And if you have ideas for books you'd like us to recommend to you, if you want to talk to us on Twitter, you can tweet to either one of us or to our Faded Mates Twitter account, or use the hashtag FadedMatesPod.
So that's been Faded Mates for this week. Don't forget to subscribe using your favorite podcasting platform. And while you're over there, if you want to give us a rating or a review or a like, or just generally say nice things about us, we love that.
We do. Everyone craves positive feedback. Or negative. Be honest. It's okay.
I'm like super, super responsive to negative feedback, which I probably shouldn't say on a podcast, but it's true. So thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you.